Thank you, Dr. Lee. First of all, let me start by acknowledging my co-authors. They didn't show up in the abstract, and I'm sorry about that, Ken and Kendall. That's my fault. But Jeremy Singer couldn't be here today, but Ken and Kendall could both be here. And they were the ones responsible for getting this funded through the Sun Grant Initiative. So the problem that we're addressing is that we're a little bit concerned about the removal of corn stover for purposes of ethanol production, because we think that we know it's probably going to end up having long-term effects on soil quality and the future of crop production in certain fields. So the objectives of our study were actually, there's three different parts of this study. It's a really big study. First of it was the corn genetics portion of it, and that's what Dr. Lampke and his graduate student were working on. And that was to see if they could identify if we could actually breed in some, the ability to handle this type of competition with these different mulches. And I think you all end up screening, what, the 50 different crosses, Dr. Lampke? Then there was the crop management portion of this, which was conducted by Dr. Jeremy Singer and his graduate student, and they basically looked at different types of chemical suppression with paraquat and Roundup, and they also looked at no-till versus strip-till and two or three different types of ground covers to see if they could identify kind of a management practice that we could apply to that. And then my portion and Dr. Moore's portion was to go through and evaluate different species to see if we could identify something that was less competitive. And in the end, we hoped that these would all come together to produce a successful production system. So living mulches by far is not a new concept, as many of you all know, but taking this approach to it is quite new. So what is a living mulch? If you read through the literature, I think it kind of becomes biased sometimes according to a researcher's focus. A lot of times the first thing they'll put forth is pest, and some people put forth erosion. Some people put forth weed management. But I define it as an annual or perennial plant that you interseed with a row crop to confer an ecological, economical, or environmental benefit to a production system. And I've listed just a few potential benefits. In our case, we're kind of biased because we want to reduce soil erosion in the Midwest. Other topics are weed suppression, evidence of weed suppression, reduction of insect pests, increased microbial biomass, increases in arbuscular mycorrhizal colonization. And, you know, I was surprised when I first started looking at the literature. We're even seeing cases where you have increased soil moisture because we're reducing the amount of evaporation from the soil. So let's talk about what we did. This was a split block design, and we had 35 different species and a control. Three landscape positions replicated three times over 3 years, and here's just one of our replications. You can see this is the summit, the slope, and the toe slope position, and you can kind of see the variability that you see as you grow across each one of those landscape positions. Mulch, we started out establishing it in 2006. When I got to Iowa State in 2007 and picked up this study, a lot of those had not established very well, so I came back in and tried to establish them about 1.5 times their seeding rate, either with a tie drill, and if I couldn't get it with a tie drill, I almost always got it with that Brilliant Seeder. These were tilled plots when we started establishing them. Our corn planting dates, May 19th, May 14th, and April the 21st for those 3 years. This year we got really lucky. We got excited when we could get in the field at April the 21st. The variety we planted was Pioneer 34A20, and from what I understand, this variety was actually discovered by accident. It's your best high yielding and good years, and it will be your worst yielding in bad years. It's kind of known for not being able to tolerate competition very well. So it's in the study. We planted about 80,000 plants per hectare. We shot for fall strip tillage, but most of the time for 2008 and 2009, it ended up in the spring, and that was a lot of times because there were constraints on equipment availability and other things. So two of the years it actually ended up in the spring. We were tilling up about 30.5 centimeters, and that would vary depending on the ground cover species that you were looking at. I don't know if anybody's ever taken a strip tillage implement and gone through a fescue lawn or a bluegrass lawn, but you end up with a little strip the first pass about this big. Now, these are supposed to till up anywhere from 12 to 15 inches. So it was quite variable as we took this through the field, and in the first year we actually had to go through twice. We also banded on Roundup to take care of any of those spring annuals that would come up within that row. The data sets that we collected were grain yield, stover yield, population and harvest, ear counts, plant heights at two-week intervals to get an idea of plant growth rate, spring ground cover, fall ground cover, and soil fertility. The soil fertility data, the fall ground cover, and the plant heights are something I'm not going to try to get into today. We're just going to focus more on the yield. The species that we evaluate, like I say, we started out with 35. And I've kind of broken them down here to make them a little easier to digest. But these are more of your calm-stemmed or your joining cool-season grasses. We have four species of Agrostis in there, where these are common in turf and also in, well, yeah, in turf. And then we have the fine-leaf fescues. We have the more of the coarse-leafed cool season grasses, and I've grouped perennial ryegrass in with these two fescues. Something I want to say about these two fescues, they're not like Kentucky 31. These two fescues are, they're not as high yielding in biomass as Kentucky 31. They're more of a, well, both of them are actually, or Bulldog is actually a turf type, and meadow fescue, well, I think we're still trying to determine a use for meadow fescue. Now, these are the never, ever, ever put these into a study. Creeping foxtail and meadow foxtail are absolutely the worst species that you could possibly ever ask for. I would be afraid to whisper it close to the soil that they would actually pop up in a plot. They're that weedy. Then we have the bluegrasses. We had we have five different species of bluegrass. We had our warm season grasses. We had our legumes, and then we had our oddballs, which I really didn't find a group for to put them in here, but they're in this study. So let's talk a little bit about significant observations. These are things that we kind of noticed over the 3 years of the study. First off, only 18 of those 35 species that we started out with actually lived the full 3 years, with the exception of Cura clover. And I don't know if you're familiar with Cura clover, but we say the first year it sleeps, the second year it creeps, and the third year it leaps. And 2010 was the leap year for Cura clover, and it really came out. And so we are actually only able to collect data for 2010 with Cura clover. The other thing we noticed is that strip tillage wasn't that effective the first year in certain species, and that goes back to, you know, these dense sod forming grasses really were difficult to establish a strip till in. Other thing we noticed, that if we had to delay corn planting and give those C3 grasses a chance to leap out of head, it really, really would hurt corn yield. Regardless of you know, coming out and trying to band on Roundup, we weren't always hitting on that, but it didn't take much for them to encroach a short time after on that corn row. Another thing we saw, signs of stress would occur shortly after emergence. You know, you would think, oh, these are competing below ground, but no, there was something definitely going on very early in the season here. And I mistaked it the first year for iron deficiency, and I went to talk to Dr. Sawyer, and he goes, we don't have iron deficiencies in Iowa. He said, what you're seeing is probably a result of competition. And we also see, you know, signs of chlorosis in those leaves. And the other thing, and this is pretty significant, I'm going to come back and talk about this hopefully at the end if I have time, is that we would see variations within a plot as we'd walk through these. And it wasn't uncommon to see a corn plant a foot taller than the plants adjacent to it. And a lot of times that was associated with just a little more bare soil than the plants adjacent to it. And so we'll talk about that a little more in a minute. These are my type 3 test of fixed effects. We calculated several values here: grain yield, our total biomass, harvest index, population, and that is population at harvest, not population after emergence, an ear to plant ratio, so how many ears did we end up per plant, and a grain cob ratio, which this is grain dry matter to cob dry matter. What I'm trying to get at here is, you know, seed set on that ear. And then we have spring cover. As you can see, position only had an effect on population, and I'm not going to get into that right now. But species was always significant, as you would probably would expect. we saw a year have a significant effect on grain yield and population. It didn't really have much of an effect on total biomass and harvest index. Came close, though. Some people might say, yeah, you had an evidence of there of an effect. And then we saw one case where it had a position by species interaction, and didn't see any position by year interaction. We always saw a species by year interaction, and please don't ask me to explain this right now. You can read my paper whenever it comes out about this three-way interaction that we have here. I'm just kidding. You can ask me about it, but don't expect a great answer right now. So let's talk a little bit about the data that that we ended up collecting. As you can see, here's the control at 8.6 megagrams per hectare. The closest we came to is about 55% of that yield, 4.5 megagrams per hectare, and that's not uncommon for unsuppressed sod. I think in 2008, the legumes, when they were surviving, they didn't. A lot of the legumes, with the exception of cura, didn't survive. We got probably within 65 to 70% of the control those years. Total biomass followed that same trend. Harvest index. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's do this. Let's do a comparison here of our best and our worst. So here's meadow fescue, and you can see that meadow fescue. It was significantly different for grain and total biomass yield. It had a similar harvest index. It was not significant, but we see a significant effect on the population, 82,400 versus 71,900. We also see ears per plant was not significant for meadow fescue. The grain cob ratio, remember, that's grain dry matter to cob dry matter, was not significantly different. Whoops. And spring ground cover, though, when we compare that, you see this was our minimum ground cover, so that's no coincidence that the species that produced the minimum ground cover turned out to be the highest yielding in this experiment. Now let's look at the worst. Meadow foxtail. These are the grasses I told you to never, ever plant in any experiment for any reason whatsoever. We see we really took a yield on hit with meadow foxtail and in total grain yield, total biomass. But here's where it gets interesting. We see that harvest index has significantly dropped. We see the population was absolutely destroyed in this case. Ears per plant had dropped significantly, and grain to cob ratio had also dropped significantly. So this is where we're losing our yield with some of these species. And then, of course, it was also the highest ground cover in the spring. And just to give you an overview, the species by year interaction, I've kind of averaged these together and kind of give you an idea of the overall trend over the 3 years. Here's the 3-year average. Here's where these species fell. The colonial bentgrass, creeping bentgrass, hard fescue, meadow fescue, sheep fescue, and tall fescue. And then here are the crested wheatgrass, Kentucky bluegrass, meadow foxtail, red fescue, riverbank wild rye, and creepy foxtail. I got it all out. So, if you'll notice, in 2009 we had an excellent year for these particular species. And folks, I think what simply happened here, this was an establishment year. We had trouble getting those strip tills in. In 2009 we got the strip tills put in. Those particular species in that year did not encroach back onto that row as fast. However, when you come down here and look at these guys really came out fast in all years, and so you have this decreasing trend. But back up here, in 2010 we had a frost event about 2 weeks, or a week and a half, 2 weeks after we planted, and the best I can estimate, we probably set at V2 for maybe a week, week and a half, and so we had just enough time for those ground covers to jump back out again and suppress yield in that third year. So the conclusions I made from this is the higher yields were usually achieved with the lower growing species that could be successfully mechanically suppressed out of that row. The selection of overly aggressive species will have significant effects on yield through reductions in populations and that kernel set. Cool season spring conditions will give ground covers a competitive advantage over corn. And planting ground covers in strips, now this is just an idea, planting ground covers in strips starting out in a living mulch system may be a better method instead of going out and just planting the whole field and then strip tilling into it. And then based on grain yield, persistence, and ground cover, you probably could throw meadow fescue in here, but here are my recommendations just based on what I saw from this study. Now, I'm going to go with some final thoughts here. One, I think that competition for resources, this is below ground resources, is probably not the dominating problem here that we have in corn and living mulch systems. What the literature, the weed science literature, the work done by a lot of physiologists tell me, or it seems to point to, is that corn has a very, it's very, very sensitive to that red far red ratio from emergence to about V6, V8. If you let a weed pop up in a corn crop during that time period, you could hurt yield by 25 to 30% according to the literature. Anytime after V6, V8, you're talking 5% maybe. So the punishment really doesn't fit the crime, but this sensitivity to the red far red ratio probably makes a little more sense in explaining that. I think you need to define corn's personal space. Remember what I talked about earlier about seeing variability in the plot? You would see more ground cover or more soil associated with a single plant, and that plant would be taller. Clarence Swanton and I have both talked about this. We think that corn has an ideal buffer distance that it needs, probably somewhere between 4 and 6 inches around that corn plant before you can, you know, really start achieving decent growth out of that plant, and that doesn't always hold true. And the other thing is, I think future screening should focus more on warm season grasses. We included warm season grasses in this study, but we included the wrong types of warm season grasses. I've been working with a species called Nimblewill at Iowa State, grabbed it from the University of Kentucky from a weed scientist down there. I was familiar with it there. I was able to achieve, just by spraying a band of Roundup over the corn, I was able to achieve 193 bushels an acre with Nimblewill, and that's not suppressing the sod. And I think the big contributing factor to that was is it had such a delayed green up that it didn't get over into corn's personal space early in the season, and we've been seeing success with that. Side Oats Grandma also performed similar. It had 213 bushels an acre, and that's with not suppressing that Side Oats Grandma. So I think there's real potential in there, and I think that's the way the future of living mulch research probably needs to go. So I've talked enough now, and I'll take any questions. Yes?
Rather than looking at species, what about a management practice in early spring? With enough AIs around, if you can really knock off some of the cool season grasses, and that they're going to be slow for a while before they recover from, you know, something with those and some of the AIs.
Okay, you're asking about spring management. Why would we just look at spring management?
You had a really big crop. I mean, I wouldn't want to add another.
Right. Well, see, that was the beginning of the study. I talked about Dr. Singer actually worked on that portion of the study, those management factors. I was working just on species, hoping that we could bring the best of, well, all three of those studies into a good production system. So he actually worked on that. I'll let him show that data. Yes?
What was your nitrogen?
We applied 150 kilograms per hectare in the spring. We banded it right over the row. We had a Gandy air delivery seeder, and we drove over that row and banded it right over that row. It was urea, by the way. So,
at planting.
Any other questions?
No starter.
On the living mulches.
No, sorry, no starter. No starter fertilizer.
No. It was actually banded on. I think in 2008 it was a couple of days after because we had trouble getting in the field. And then the past 2 years we've done it right before, just days before we planted.